I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The UK government has advised the public and businesses that if Britain leaves the EU without a deal with Europe, mobile phone roaming charges may once again incur additional fees. Excessive roaming fees were largely killed off by the EU law incrementally over the last few years, to the point that now if you do travel to another country within Europe from the UK or vice versa, you can use your calls, texts and data like you would at home. But the government has been publishing a whole bunch of guidance statements this week around what to prepare for in the instance of a no-deal Brexit. And in its guidance statement related specifically to mobile phone roaming, in fact, it said that if we had a no-deal scenario, the government would legislate at least to ensure that requirements on mobile operators to apply a financial limit on mobile data usage while abroad is retained in UK law, which is similar to the law that exists in Europe if you go over your allowance, for example. And that limit, the government said, would be set at £45 per monthly billing period. So that's the maximum your network could charge you if roaming fees are reintroduced. Now, the government insists that a no-deal Brexit is highly unlikely. And in a Radio 4 broadcast this week, I heard Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab say that even a no-deal Brexit wouldn't bring back roaming charges. And I've seen a whole bunch of reports now from websites that state that networks like Three and Vodafone and O2 and others won't reintroduce roaming charges, but I've been doing a lot of research into this, and what they all appear to have basically said is that they either don't want to, they don't plan to, that it would be bad for business to do so, or all three of those examples, but not that they 100% absolutely definitely commit to not doing it. And so I think that there's a little bit of confusion there. But Ian, what's your take on this? I mean, let's just assume for the sake of argument, we have a no-deal Brexit, we pull out, and we have to consider roaming charges. What do you think is the most likely scenario?
Well, I don't think that there will be roaming charges, because I don't think it's in anyone's interest to reintroduce them particularly. I mean, obviously, we don't know what business is going to look like if we do leave the EU, and especially if we leave without with no deal. So from what I can sort of predict, I would suggest that for a start, the EU rule on no data roaming is included now in UK law, right? Because it was brought in with all the other laws. So for the time being, that law will stay, and charging roaming would be different. If it is, I believe there is a law to it, right? You've looked into this. Is that correct? It is. The law is for the EU that it is not allowed to charge data roaming charges at all.
It's not. The law is essentially that you have to be able to use your plan like you can at home.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't stop you. It doesn't stop charges over and above your included allowance.
Sure. And there are often different usage limits when you're abroad as well, right? Because although Three is unlimited data in the UK, it is limited in the EU. I can't use more than, I think it's 12 gigs, right?
Yeah, and some networks do also have a slightly different take on that. But the general principle is that you can use it like you can at home. But if you go over and you incur additional charges, you can't be billed more than, I think the EU law is 50 euros. Ours is going to be £45, which is about about parity there.
Yeah, now you see that is an interesting point that you've raised there, because actually, ignoring the service providers for a second, because we'll come to that in a bit, that sort of suggests, doesn't it, that actually roaming charges could come back, but there might be a cap on the amount you can spend.
No, that's literally what's being proposed, is that if they do come back, there will be a cap.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's no good, is it? Because a cap is no use to anyone. It you could reach that £45 limit like you would in America, you know, within minutes, literally within minutes. If you get off the plane in the States and you don't have a roaming contract, and your iPhone decides to download some podcasts, you're scuppered, right? At £7 a meg or whatever it costs for most, non-EU roaming. So from that perspective,
That cap is useless. We might as well disregard it because it's not helpful to people. That's not what people want. People want to be able to go to countries and even if they have to pay a fair amount that's, you know, ideally an amount included in their tariffs. Now, obviously, the law, if that's the case, if there is a law that prevents them charging, then that's fine. It will be in the UK law. It will be the same.
The reason that it works, or at least the reason the law works, is because it put everybody on an equal playing field. No company Yes. wanted to be the first or the last to introduce something because it can negatively damage them. And I think you could see the same thing in reverse if roaming charges were reintroduced, because who wants to be the first network that says it has to reintroduce mobile charges? You know, it's instantly going to either lose customers just by the fact that that is a change in their contract, or the fact that other networks will jump on it as a marketing opportunity, and the benefit of the increased customer acquisition, it will offset the financial cost to actually taking that customer if they happen to go abroad and use a bunch of data. And all of this is hypothetical because we could have a deal Brexit. There's the slimmest possibility we have no Brexit or a delayed Brexit, and all of this is up in the air. But I've just seen a lot of conflicting reports since this guidance paper was published that said that all of these mobile phone companies in the UK aren't going to reintroduce it, whereas strictly speaking they're saying they don't want to and aren't planning on doing it, but that doesn't actually mean that they won't.
But they wouldn't say that anyway, would they? I mean, it's not in any company's interest to say we're going to put the prices up soon or eventually or whatever. It's not the way that business works. I don't think it will be a problem. I'm more worried about literally everything else. And ultimately, there was always the opportunity to buy an EU SIM if you wanted to. So, you know, we've just seen Apple, announce that multiple SIMs are coming to iPhones, which obviously was an unusual thing to happen. So perhaps in the future, it will be companies like Apple that will hold the power and they will say, well, you can have two SIMs now. You know, you don't need to worry about it. You could just load on an EU SIM while you're abroad and pay very little for data.
Let us know any thoughts you have on this topic, of course. hello@techpodcast.uk, or send us your message in the form of einen tweet. Not quite sure where the German came from there. At text message pod, we scour both of those places for your opinions, and we would love to include them next week's show. As a reminder, you're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And if you're one of our patrons, this is your extended ad-free version of this week's show. But if you're not a patron and would like to get our ad-free extended versions or listen and interact with us live, we've got a whole bunch of people in the chat room right now. Hello to you. Then head to patreon.com/UK Tech to get instant access to our entire back catalogue of extended shows. And remember, there's no commitment. Sadly, also to remember, we have no new patrons this week, but thanks to everybody who is supporting us on Patreon, you guys make the show possible. EE will no longer be the only option for British customers wanting to use an Apple Watch as a 4G phone, as Vodafone said its network will support Apple's latest flagship, which was announced Wednesday, along with new iPhones. Now, we'll talk about new iPhones when we've actually used them, but you don't really need us to go over the fact that they exist or what their specs are. Although later on the extended Patreon version of the show, we are going to do a little few minutes just talking about our first impressions, as we know you guys like to listen to us geek out on that sort of stuff. And we're going to do a much bigger review, most likely next week, for everyone once the products are in our hands. And also apologies, this top half of this show has become a little bit of a mobile phone centric episode, but unfortunately, that is the nature of the game. And this week, there's just...
Well, it was always going to be a bit like this, wasn't
it?
And this week,
it was...
I mean, it's hard to avoid.
There's just been a lot of it to talk about. But anyway, back to the news. Customers are going to be able to use the Apple Watch to make calls using the same number as the iPhone that it's paired with, even if the phone is switched off or out of battery. Now, this is according to a spokesperson I spoke to at Vodafone this week as I was writing a story on this topic for Bloomberg. Vodafone also confirmed it's going to support the current Apple Watch models, which is to say the Series 3, which has LTE and is currently only supported by EE. Now, this is an important change for more than just Apple customers, and this is why I really wanted to talk about it. For the current 4G-equipped Apple Watch, networks had to physically alter the way that their infrastructure was set up to support one phone number across multiple devices and to use eSIM chips, which, unlike the removable ones we're all used to, are actually embedded within the products themselves. Now, this is going to be important for things like Internet of Things devices. We're all expected to have, I don't know, somewhere around a trillion devices each per square footage of our own houses before too long. But also more immediately, because eSIMs aren't exclusive to Apple, other products that use them can potentially be added to the networks that support the technology. I did a little bit of a research on this, and that includes Microsoft's latest Surface Book Pro tablet that uses an eSIM. There are certain laptops from HP and Lenovo, and also the most recent Samsung Galaxy Watch, which I think was only announced last month, uses an eSIM. But so far, EE was the only one to have done so in Britain. But it won't be long, I imagine, before we see other networks support this technology.
Well, a little bit of trivia.
Mate, honestly, I wake up every morning and I put my pants on and I have a cup of tea. Then I sit down and then I think, I wish Ian was here because I need some trivia.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole reason that you couldn't have two phones on one SIM, one number, you know, one account, as it were, was back in the day. It was more of a security thing. I mean, this was years ago when I was when I think digital phones were first a thing. Yeah, in fact, it must have been. One of the questions that, because I used to work in Currys, and my friend Nathan was like a full timer there, and he had like these meetings with the providers, obviously as they still do to this day. And he said, so why can't you have two phones with the same number? And they said, well, it's a security thing, because obviously it means, you know, we can't have people being able to clone numbers and using an unlimited number of phones on the network. Because it was always like a thing, you know, why couldn't you have a phone for, you know, the house and a phone for the car all on the same number? But of course, they've probably managed to work out how to make it much more secure now and much more, you know, easy to keep it safe. But it's actually quite exciting, because I think the future of, you know, things like 5G offering connectivity to lots of devices, it could just be a start of something that's a little bit more free than just having one phone. How useful most of us would find that in a world where we're really not making phone calls that much, I don't know, but it's an interesting possibility.
And I think, you know, the key thing here is to bear in mind what's happening with 5G, and to put this into context a little bit, I actually spent a little bit of time last week with the head of BT, well, not the head of BT, but she was very senior woman at BT, who's in charge of deploying a lot of technologies for EE. And we were talking about the kind of fundamental difference between a 4G mast and an equivalent 5G mast in terms of the capacity they can individually hold. And 4G is somewhere around the 10,000 devices per cell. So if you want to double capacity in an area to accommodate 20,000 people, you need to double the cells. 5G is measured in something ridiculous like 10 million or 5 million. It's like 1,000 times greater capacity. And so that argument that you were talking about, that your friend at Currys had many years ago, about not overloading a network or having too many devices, that sort of rendered, you know, nearly obsolete, at least for the foreseeable near and medium term future, because it's never going to get to that point.
And it's quite important, isn't it? Because a lot of people are sort of, you know, doing hand wringing about 5G and, you know, what it will offer. And the reality for 5G isn't really that it's not so much of a new standard as it is an opportunity to provide things. I mean, the Internet of Things is what gets spoken about most, because it's obviously what people are thinking about now. But the idea of having a lot more devices that can connect to a network. And you were saying something interesting the other night, weren't you, about how the 4G network is the backbone of the 5G network. Like, you have to have the 4G network before you can have the 5G one.
Yes, the 5G is dependent on 4G. But in the same way that 3G, in a similar way rather, to how 3G was a necessary legacy technology to keep around for 4G, because initially 4G didn't support voice. So if you made a phone call over 4G, it would actually drop down to the 3G network. But now 4G is capable of supporting voice, and most networks support that. And so a lot of networks are just going to drop 3G altogether, which I'm not entirely happy with, for what it's worth, because depending on the frequency of the network that you can sometimes have a better experience with 3G in maybe yeah. indoors or something like that. And Stephen Huxtable asked in the chat room, is 2G gone altogether? No, it isn't, actually. 2G is still around and is used a lot by things like emergency services, and there's certain restrictions that networks have, I think, legally or contractually in response to their requirement under licensing spectrum rules, that they have to provide a basic telephone service across, you know, basically 100% or nearly 100% of the UK's landmass. And so you find a lot of companies actually deploy new masts in order to cover a very tiny area of land that doesn't have any coverage because they have to, and it's expensive.
How does that work with companies like EE, though, that have never had a 2G network?
They have a 2G network. I mean, 2G isn't, remember, 2G isn't specific to data. You know,
I know, but it was more that it was because I'm getting old, obviously, and because Three never had a 2G network, did it? It used to rent Orange, was that right? Orange or T-Mobile?
Initially, it did. Yeah.
And then they killed that off, so they didn't have anything. But you can make voice calls over 3G, so yeah. Therefore that problem was null and void. And I guess
exactly.
Yeah.
And this is why it's so interesting when we talk about things like eSIMs, because if you have if you're in the Apple ecosystem, you can assign your Apple ID to ring a bunch of your devices, you know, your laptop, your iPad, your phone, your computer, all at the same time if someone phones your phone number. But that's all done on Apple's side with just some clever forwarding of data and routing of data. The idea behind the eSIM technology is that you could have that exact same experience across all your devices, regardless of manufacturer, and essentially have one phone number that applies to multiple devices. Like, that is technically something that it could do. It won't be, because it's always going to be to do with data rather than phone calls, you know, and that's a big difference, and all of these devices just want to do it for data. But but anyway, that's why it's interesting that Vodafone has now started to offer the Apple Watch, and hopefully that's given you a little bit of understanding as to why it's more interesting than perhaps you may first expect. Let us know any thoughts you have on this. Of course, hello@techpodcast.uk. Ian, have you ever been watching a live stream of something everyone else is watching on TV, only to have highlights spoilt for you on social media by a few seconds because your stream was slightly delayed compared to what other people were seeing on their regular telly boxes?
No, never.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, because I don't watch sport, and that's literally the only thing I can think of. And I wouldn't be on Twitter if I was watching a drama.
Strictly speaking, I never said sport. I said a live stream of something everyone else is watching. Now, that could be, for example, the Great British Bake Off. It could be a celebrity vote the worst person off television type thing.
No, don't watch those.
Well, I have. I've had many Great British Bake Offs spoilt for me by this issue. But this is more of an issue, I think, for sport. And definitely if you're really, really obsessed with who's going to get voted off the, you know, who's got the best lungs or longest spine or whatever the recent voting off a person game show trend is, because obviously that can be extremely upsetting. But the BBC's R&D Centre has been working on a solution to this that, if deployed, it said this week, would put a live internet stream on equal footing to a terrestrial Freeview broadcast. Now, I can tell, Ian, from the sound of your heavy breathing that this excites you to a point of near arousal. Now, this system is highly technical, as you can imagine, but here's my own little explanation of how the highlights of the BBC's experiment works. Today, when you stream a live football game, for example, you're not actually streaming it directly from the broadcaster. You're streaming it from what's called a content delivery network, or CDN, which simplistically is that little, it's kind of a middleman between the broadcaster and you. The broadcaster encodes a few seconds of live video and passes that to the CDN, and then it's the CDN that optimizes that in order for being you know, to be distributed to huge numbers of people simultaneously. And each of these little steps causes a tiny bit of delay or latency. So one of the BBC's solutions that it's sort of prototyping right now is essentially to just not wait for a few seconds of video at a time and to just push everything progressively through when it's available. But that requires a change on the parts of these content delivery networks in order to support. So you need to get like a whole bunch of industry investment to do this. And the BBC also said that it wants to make sure that if you have a super fast and reliable internet connection, that you're not being forced to, you know, to buffer the same amount of content as someone whose connection is a bit flaky or slow, which is often how it works today. And these are just sort of two examples of things that it's working on. And Engadget had a nice summary of this as well, but it also pointed out that Microsoft's Mixer game streaming service comes close to offering near zero latency. So it's all possible. It's been about priorities, I think, up to this point, and terrestrial broadcasters have been a bit more focused on their catch-up service content and advertising models, and maybe a little bit less focused on on latency of streaming, and perhaps understandably. But I think that this could make a big difference for people who want to kind of ditch the cable box, as it were, and move entirely to streaming. And certainly I would appreciate it for Eurovision. But Ian, I get the sense that you couldn't care less.
I couldn't care less. That's absolutely true. I mean, I obviously I do care because I think the technical details of it are really interesting. And I think that, for live streaming, it's inconvenient, I suppose, if you're watching the news, for example, and, you know, they say it's 9 o'clock and you look at your watch and it's 9:01 or whatever. I don't think this ever really matters to anyone. I can see why it would be a nice thing to tweak, and I like the idea of the fact that someone somewhere is sitting down and having a little think about it.
I'll tell you what, mate. Honestly, I have to disagree. I think this will matter to a lot more people than you probably think.
Why?
Well, I mean, for example, imagine you are out. Maybe you're at work or something and you don't have a television, but you are able to stream a game
on your... Well, then presumably I'll be working.
Some people can multitask.
I can't,
and they can
enough.
Watch a live football game while simultaneously doing work or something along those lines. And for those people, you know, who may well have people around them who are watching on Twitter or shouting something out, like just being a little bit ahead of that, it removes that annoyance factor of essentially having your... goals scooped, or if someone's voted off Britain's best chin competition, that you're not having that spoilt a few seconds too early. I think it is important to some people. Not to me, obviously. Okay. Not to you, but...
Fine. I mean, latency is a pain. It's one of the things that ruins everything for everyone. So, I mean, you know, fine. And the more time gets spent thinking about latency and how to reduce it, the better every experience will be, essentially. It would improve my gaming experience if people were, you know, like, well, we've discovered this way to make latency less, then great.
Yeah.
But I can't get excited about not having the outcome of Bake Off sport for me because I never watch it. And I don't care. It's baking. How can you make a baking thing a competition? Makes no sense.
I think 10 million people a week would probably disagree with you.
Yeah, maybe.
Probably, definitely.
I'm used to being contrary to the rest of society's opinions.
Yes. Well, so am I for the majority of the time. But unfortunately, on this occasion, I have to fall in line with the status quo and just think, you know what? I don't want to know whose buns have been burnt before they've come out of the proving drawer. It's not how baking works, actually. Pangolin Sandwich in the chat room says that we watch Bake Off 5 days late without spoilers. And with that in mind, no stream has 5 day latency. So maybe all of this is an entirely moot point. But there we go.
And also she said, shut your face, Morris, which I think really would cause problems for this podcast. I mean, you could do it on your own, but if you want to do that, presumably you would already.
Yes, and I don't wish to do it on my own. Some things are better with two people.
That's very true.
hello@techpodcast.uk. What's your favourite thing to do with two people? Sky has partnered with the Walking Dead producer Skybound Entertainment to create a new joint mobile venture, Skybound Stories. This is according to a GamesIndustry.biz write-up this week. The industry blog said that Skybound Stories will focus on the development of narrative-focused mobile games using episodic formats and allowing for player choice, i.e. different outcomes or scenarios, rather than a linear, unchangeable story experience. The venture will create new worlds and fiction for some of its games, while others will use existing stories and shows for inspiration, commonly known in geek parlance as new and existing IP. So what could this mean? Well, I went through Wikipedia to find a list of shows that Sky has originally produced to find out what my favourites were, and realised that one of my favourite of all time that Sky produced was called An Idiot Abroad, which was the comedy travel programme fronted by Ricky Gervais's mate Carl Pilkington. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to have a role-playing game where each week you get to navigate a virtual Carl Pilkington through a bizarre world of challenges? Like, I think that would be a fantastic way of promoting a television program. I would pay it. I might even put down some in-app purchases. That is the kind of renegade I am. Or let's not forget the other Sky classic, Gadget Geeks, the weekly consumer tech show hosted by... Ian, who hosted Gadget Geeks on Sky?
I don't know. Some guy. I think he's got a Top Gear show now or something like that, hasn't he?
That was Rory, but there was another person I know.
Was it Emma Barnett you're thinking of? Yeah, she's got that Radio 5 show.
No,
yeah,
another one of our friends. I know who it was.
Tom Scott.
No.
Tom Scott. He's very big on YouTube.
No, he's not one of my friends. The other one, it was you. That's right. It was, yes. So just imagine, everyone, a game where you could play something like Ian Morris Simulator or Ian Morris Tycoon or Theme Ian Morris, like Theme Hospital or Theme Park or something like that. Like, that is the future that Sky is literally promising us will happen. There's no hyperbole in that whatsoever. Sky is going to make an Ian Morris Simulator game. Well, back to the news, because of course that happened last week, which would make it the olds. I think this is a very smart idea. I mean, the Walking Dead series has been, I think, highly successful. It's both a popular show, popular game.
Oh God! And they've announced they've got a 10-year further plan for it. Good grief! But Skybound are quite good, aren't they? They're quite acclaimed as a game producer. People like the stories. They have a very specific style to them, don't they? But they're not. But it's all about the story with those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Skybound Entertainment, I think, has been around for a few years, maybe 2010, something like that, I think they were founded. So, you know, relatively recent, but the company is very well acclaimed. And so it seems like a good partnership. I just hope that they pick the right stories and the right programs to do this with. And I think it could be very, very successful. I remember back in the 90s, there was a really experimental show on, I think, maybe ITV, where it was essentially a choose-your-own-adventure story, but on live television. Or not live television, but... they filmed multiple different parts of the show, and in the ad break you would call in to, you know, to choose what the next thing should be. You know, should the you know, woman A say this or say this, or should man A do this or do that? And the most popular outcome would then play in the next segment, and then in the next ad break you choose the next. And you know, it obviously didn't work super well, otherwise it would be a format mirrored today ad nauseum.
Well, it sort of is a bit, because Netflix does interactives. They're not great. Like, there's one for I can't remember what's that. Well, they've got several anyway, and they're aimed at children. Because as you probably remember as a child, choose your own adventures were quite a big thing, right? You know, you would you'd have a book and you'd have to decide what happened, or you'd roll a dice or something like that.
Yes.
So the idea is solid for sure.
Definitely. I mean, it worked at the time because you could charge people 50 pence a call to call in and do that. But, yeah. You know, part of me, with hindsight, just kind of wants to know, well, what were the many other options that could have happened? You know, did they put them out on a VHS? In fact, could you imagine Choose Your Own Adventure on VHS? you know,
fast forward this 10 minutes. In fact, Nate, I'm pretty sure that was a thing.
Really?
Actually.
Good Lord.
I'm pretty sure it was. Because, you know, one of the things about DVDs when they were introduced was that they were sold as there's seamless branching. So you can, you press a button and it would take you to a completely different outcome. So the idea was obviously you could use that to watch either the director's cut or the not director's cut. You could just leave it alone and it would do that. But of course, the idea being that you could have a game as well, but it doesn't work because those formats are optimized for video watching. They're not optimized for games, so they're a nightmare to use.
Well, what wouldn't be a nightmare to play? That's the question. If you have an answer and would like to propose a television series that would make a fantastic companion to a game, or realistically vice versa, as is the nature of this story, then do let us know. hello@techpodcast.uk. Now, we didn't have any massive emails come in over the last week. I think people are still getting used to the fact that we're just back from our summer break. But we did have one question that was sitting in the inbox from Matt, one of our patrons, who said, are there any plans to celebrate the 150th episode in the same way you did the 100th? The simple answer is no, we haven't. But the less simple answer is no, but what would you like us to do? Is there something we could do? I mean, I'll be honest, we're not going to do a live show for 150, maybe for 200. That's quite possible. But for 150, we hadn't thought of anything in particular. So let us know if you have anything you'd like us to do for episode 150, which will be coming up.
That would be interesting to find out. When is it?
Mid to late October. You know, if there's something that we would like us to do, then let us know. hello@techpodcast.uk. Obviously, you can tweet us at textmessagepod with your thoughts. Or if you're one of our patrons, pop it in our Discord channel or at patreon.com/UKtech. Text message, of course, keeps you informed, very informed, about the British tech landscape. But let's check in with our friend Tom Merritt, a Daily Tech News show in the US, and hear what's been happening in the wider world of tech over the last week.
Hey, welcome back. It's good to have you back. It's good to be back here telling you about the stuff we talked about on Daily Tech News Show last week, including, of course, all the big Apple announcements. We'll tell you whether we think you should buy any of them, and if so, why. And we talk about whether Facebook, Google, and Amazon are too big to let exist as they are. Should they be broken up? All of that and more coming up on DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Thank you, Tom. And that's true. If you can't wait for some further smart analysis of Apple's announcements from this week, do check out the relevant DTNS episode from this week at dailytechnewsshow.com. We're saving the bulk of our impressions for when we get the products in our hands, likely just in time for next week's show.
And thank you to our patrons supporting us every week. If you're not yet a patron but would like to get our ad-free extended version of each week's show, plus listen and interact with us as we record live, head to patreon.com/UKtech and help us finish the month with one more patron than we had last month.
Plus, send any comments to hello@techpodcast.uk. Follow us on Twitter @textmessagepod to keep up to date with all the most important UK technology headlines throughout the week as we go. And thanks to everyone listening to us on our free ad-supported feed too. If you have just a minute to leave us a review on iTunes, it really is the best way of supporting us without spending a single penny. And from me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
We'll see you in a week.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.